Today I'm talking to Michael Valdez, the Executive Vice President of International Expansion at eXp Realty. Michael's main role at eXp is building on the current footprint of Canada, Australia, and the United Kingdom, and growing exponentially into other international markets. Before eXp, Michael was a Senior Vice President of Global Servicing for Realogy Corporation, where he oversaw the international servicing platform for all Realogy brands, including Century 21, Coldwell Banker, ERA, Better Homes and Gardens, Corcoran, Klein, and Sotheby's International Realty in 113 countries. Michael was with Realogy in a variety of roles for 15 years. And before his career in real estate, he was the director of private banking at Deutsche Bank for just under a decade. There, he oversaw a book of business of just under $1 billion. Needless to say, Michael knows abundance. What Michael also knows is humble beginnings. Before coming to the United States, Michael's father was a political prisoner of Cuba. Michael grew up in a family where they worked hard for everything they had. Most inspiring about Michael is that he is warm, he's loving, he's giving, and he clearly knows just one mindset, the mindset of abundance. Thanks for listening to the Jerry Metcalf Podcast, where top real estate agents tell how they do it. This podcast was created for real estate agents across the country to come together, sharing ideas to take your, their, and our business to the next level. All right, everybody, it's the Jerry Metcalf Podcast. And today we have quite the special guest, Michael Valdez with eXp. He is the vice president and he is bringing this company international. There's so much to talk about. You're in New York City, you're at Sotheby's, you're at Realogy, you're at eXp, you're vibrant, you have a podcast.
I do.
Wildly connected and successful. So I unloaded a lot on everybody, but let's hear about you. Give us your little introduction or big introduction of yourself. And thank you for being on the show, by the way.
Oh, Jerry, thank you for asking. This is actually really great. It's fun to spend time with you and to see you. And congratulations on your podcast. It's like, it's incredible. It's fantastic. And you're going to be a guest on mine really soon.
I'm looking forward to that, by the
way.
Me
too. So a little bit about me. I know that we learned about each other at Sotheby's, and I was with Sotheby's for 13 years. I then moved over to Realogy, which is the parent company of Sotheby's, and was senior vice president for Realogy, overlooking all of the brands, which include Sotheby's, Coldwell Banker, Century 21, ERA, Better Homes and Garden, and Corcoran. So took care of all of the international business on that side, which was 106 companies,
everybody.
It's six companies, that's right, 113 countries. And it was a heck of a lot. Right pre-COVID, I was traveling 200 days a year, 250,000 miles. American Airlines loved me. I got 4 million miles in America. And they keep calling me now, sort of saying, are you okay? And then after Realogy, after 15 years at Realogy, I moved over to eXp just 3 months ago, and I'm executive vice president of their international expansion. They're currently in three countries, which is Canada, the UK, and Australia. And right now, last week, we just announced five new countries, which we're going to be entering before the end of the year, which is South Africa, France, Portugal, Mexico, and India. So it's going to be a ride, and I've got about another 20 countries in the queue. So it's a healthy pipeline. So we're really doing some wonderful things with this brand, but I'm also, as you said, I've got a podcast called the Global Luxury Real Estate Mastermind. And I also, I am the chairman of the board of Aria Global, and I sit on the board of NAREP, which is the
so
National
Tell Association. Everybody what ARIA stands for the
Sure, it's the Asian Real Estate Association of America. And so I am on the global side, which is really their global membership. So they have They have a strong membership outside of the United States as well, which we're continuing to grow. And so we do have a board for ARIA Global, and I serve as their chair of that board. And on the NAREP side, which is the National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals, I also sit on their board. So I'm very active in our industry as well. Also, and in my spare time, I don't have any.
I was going to say, in your spare time, to do all of this. So, wow. I mean, that is just like, so everybody, it's obvious why Michael's on the show, because he has perspective from more angles than most people ever. You know, even the icons of our industry don't have the kind of exposure, knowledge. I mean, your network, your wealth of knowledge of realtors. You and I share many good friends, some of my besties on the show, including Maya de la Vega and Shen Schultz, whom I was like, I mean, that just speaks volumes.
Shen is my Zen master. I love Shen.
You know, Shen's been on the show twice, but he's done, I think we talk about this on the show, he's done like, I know he's done 10-day, I don't know if he's done the 20-day silent retreats, meditations.
Well, do you know his father was a Buddhist monk?
Right, and he's very much Buddhist. He's very much. Oh my God.
Yeah, we've spoken about this at length. I mean, I'm only half joking when I say he's like my Zen master. Every time I'm around Shen, it's just sort of like, it's calm, right? Oh, yeah. It's amazing.
I met him in Santa Barbara, and I remember it was at the Sotheby's Market Leaders event, and there were 45 of us, and I had never been to one. I just didn't even know what I was invited to. And I literally, like, I saw Shen, and I literally walked up and I said, "You're going to be my friend." Like, I was like, I just knew. I was like, I just
could be his aura, right?
Yeah. I just knew. I was like, you're my friend.
It's just so amazing.
And you know, we start
talking about like the lotus flower, right? And he sort of says, you know, a lotus flower is one of the most beautiful flowers on earth, and it can only grow in mud and dirt. And it's that juxtaposition of the two, right? And so it's amazing, right? And you know when that came about, when we were talking about the Malibu fires, when his house burned down.
Oh, and his entire community where he sold houses.
Right.
His entire business burned down at the same time.
And so his first post on social media after the fires was thanking the firemen for their valiant effort. Not the fact that I just lost my house and I lost all my personal belongings, but thank you for the firemen who were actually trying to help save his home. And it was just like,
that
perspective is something that is just so rare. He's a great human being.
He is. And that speaks a lot of you. So like you've become so far in the business, but take us back, like childhood, parents, what was it like? And how did that lead you to today?
Yeah, well, it's sort of, I was born and raised in New York. My dad was an attorney. My dad was from Cuba. My mom was from Spain. And my dad had his own sort of political history in Cuba and was a political prisoner that was released during the Bay of Pigs. So it was a really interesting sort of way to grow up because of the way of the perspective that he had. It was always the idea that there's really no safety net, right? And so it really is just go and do it, and that it could be taken away any day at any time. And so it was that type of thing where I think that's where the drive comes from, where you just sort of keep going. And so I was in banking for a long time. I was in banking with Deutsche Bank, and I was the first Latino director of Deutsche Bank in the United States. And I was 25 years old at the time. And so I was with Deutsche Bank for 10 years, and then I went into real estate, actually. So it's been a nice journey. Yeah. And so I've been in real estate for 16 years now.
So in getting into real estate, so this will give us some perspective on your international, just the way you tap into international well, is you had parents who were international from Cuba and Spain.
Right.
When you guys came, you were born here or did you?
I was born in New York, yes.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. So you were born in New York with parents who
I was first
really
generation.
Had to start over. And you were a part of that growing up.
100%. You know, when you're first generation, you sort of see it through your parents' eyes and you sort of see it through another perspective, right? And you start sort of looking at that and you really are appreciative of everything. And, you know, and, you know, my parents worked hard and, you know, it was a good upbringing, and it's that type of thing where that's also that responsibility of giving back at that point, where you also want to make sure that you're mentoring others and, you know, you're really cognizant of that diversity and you're really trying to make sure that you're out there representing, you know, yourself. I was probably one of the highest ranking officers at Realogy that was of Latino descent. Wow. I probably am the same at EXP. And so it is that type of thing where you want to make sure that if you're lucky enough to be at that table, you want to make sure that you're inviting others to sit there too.
Well, make sure you get the smartest people. You know, let's make sure let's not miss out on all of the talent that this world has to offer.
100%.
It taps into your global perspective. Is different,
that's right.
Different cultures. I should let you say, but just, I work with a lot of cultures, a lot of different people, and there's so much to be offered from being with a global company you are much more global than I am, but you just get so many perspectives and it keeps you open-minded. It keeps you sharp. And we all need that to grow. And the world is getting so small.
Oh my God. It is the idea that, you know, I think that traveling is the best education ever, right? You learn so much from all of the other cultures. And what you really learn is how much more alike we are than different, and how much more similarities we have than not. We may sort of look at things a little bit differently. We may sort of read from left to right. We may sort of use different characters. But in the core of who we are as human beings, we all still want the same things in life.
And isn't it interesting how, or what do you think about this? Social media has kind of opened, you know, there's a lot of negativity about it. But for me, I've noticed how internet, digital, whatever, has opened doors for international relationships that were never open before, where the wall that might have been put up in the past from one person in one country to another country is completely pulled back, where there's just you can have so many relationships person to person that the wall of assumptions about differences in culture and belief systems there's that filter that's been there for so long that in many ways has gotten pulled back, because we can just talk to one another now.
It is so true. You start thinking about even other platforms, forget about the social media in this country. How many of your friends do you know that have WeChat accounts, right? It's basically the social media of mainland China because of the firewalls that China has, and they don't allow Facebook and Instagram and all of that we're so used to. But all of our colleagues that really do sort of play in that luxury world and in that international world, everyone has a WeChat account. And so for your listeners that don't know what it is, it's something
you
go in and you actually do need a sponsor. So it's either you or me. I'm happy to sponsor any one of your listeners onto WeChat. So it's one of those things that, you know, you have to start looking at it from a global perspective.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So for you, how did you grew up with your parents, what did they do for a living, and how did that affect your path and where you are now?
So my dad was an attorney, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom. And so it's sort of that, you know, that cultural thing back then. And it was, you know, I'm 53, so it was a different era. And so it was what was done, especially in a Latin culture. And so I think I was expected to go to law school, which I did not, because I still remember the idea of, you know, sort of having that workaholic father that was almost like an absentee father. And so you really just like said, oh, I don't want to do that. And so
traveled for 200 days out of the year.
Oh, no, I just did something that was a lot less hours. So I went into banking like an idiot. And so then I was sort of like, so then I was used to my 12-hour days, which was exactly the same thing that my dad did. So it was all full circle at that point. But then, you know, I think that the lifespan of the banker is about at that decade. And, you know, and I was in banking during 9/11. And yeah. I think that the world obviously changed and everything changed in banking then as well. And, you know, I was dealing with a lot of international clients. I mean, I've always had, my business has always been international, both in finance and real estate. So for the last 26 years, I've just always had an international focus. And so it was that type of a thing where it was just that that international thing all changed during after 9/11. The risk management changed, the ideas of those structured products that you were doing for those types of clients all went away. And so it was during that time that, you know, I was pretty burnt out. And so I caught, you know, I was very fortunate. It was good timing. I caught a lot of that early tech money that was coming in, a lot of that Silicon Valley thing. So, you know, I was very, very grateful and thankful for the position that I was in at that point in time. And so at the time, I actually had a home in East Hampton. I was living in New York. And it was really, really difficult in those like times to get to the house when it was, you know, like peak traffic and stuff like that. So I actually bought a place in Miami because it was sometimes easier just to get to Miami. And yeah, so then I was spending a lot more time there, and I eventually relocated there. And so I had met the person.
So what year was it, Miami?
I moved to Miami in 04, somewhere around there.
9/11, I'm going to be embarrassed if I'm wrong, but it was 2001.
2001, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
2001 was 9/11, and then Miami.
And so I left banking probably left banking at the beginning of 03, I'd say. So I stayed a little bit longer. And so I probably left at the beginning of 03, and I probably ended up in Miami because I just started buying properties for myself in 03. And so, you know, I didn't know what I was going to do next or if I wanted to do anything next. You know, I was in a great position. And so I actually met the person who owned the Sotheby's franchise prior to Mai's franchise. There was one before then. And so I met them through a mutual friend. And so this person was actually the person, his name was Carlos Justo. And he actually had the original reality show around real estate on TLC back in 2004.
Wow.
So the very first reality show. So it was called-
My Mai actually talks about that someone held Sotheby's before she did.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
She still envisioned it for her.
So that's right. So yeah. Long story short, I ended up talking to him. He convinced me to come in, and I actually started running the team. And I came in and I ran the team like I did with my bank and my team of bankers that were under me. And so every single morning, if you could imagine this, I had a meeting at 8 a.m. in Miami at 8 a.m. Everyone had to come dressed. So you had to have a jacket. You had to have, you know, you had to come dressed. And so if you didn't, you would go home. And so part of this team, we became an elite team. There was sales meetings every single morning. And so we looked at what was available on the expires. That was a war room. That sort awesome. Of conference room was a war room. And so we ended up being one of the most elite teams, not only in Miami-Dade County, but in the state of Florida. And so
go ahead. How many, when you started that, so I'm going to do a review quickly.
Sure.
So you grew up in New York, you got into banking, you weren't going to work 12-hour days, but then you're like, oh, just kidding, I'm working 12-hour days.
That's right.
Then 9/11 happened.
Yep.
Then you ran, it sounds like that was kind of you ran into some fortunate situations that got you a little bit financially independent from 11 to 04. So tell us a little about that.
Well, I mean, it was just being in banking and sort of like being in the right time.
Investing in the right places.
Yeah, it was sort of like, you know, it was the early tech years. So, you know, you couldn't really go wrong. And so
now you're just here for fun. Great.
No, it was sort of like, no, I still work very hard.
I'm here for fun.
I'm back to my 12-hour days, by the way.
And we're all here for fun. I just have to be here, just for the record.
So now I'm back to my 12-hour days. And but I do have fun. And it's sort of like, and I'm loving it. And so, and you know, and it's that whole idea of that discipline and doing things and really continuing.
Exactly. So we're going to I'm going to tap into that. I'm going to run through because I want everybody to kind of remember what you just said. So 04, so 03, you're buying property in Miami. 04, you moved to Miami.
Yeah.
Then you meet Carlos, Carlos Justo, who then talks you into joining him at Sotheby's and running his team, which you ran like you run a bank, had them meet every day, 8 a.m., dressed to the nines, and focused with an agenda.
That's right.
So that you became the most elite top team in Miami?
So it was, you know, when somebody wanted a farm area, there was 8 people on the team. So anyone that can ask a question, if you didn't have the answer to that question, I didn't give you the farm area. And it wasn't me being difficult. It was the fact that there was other elite teams running around. And so my entire focus, because I didn't grow up in Miami, I knew that I didn't go to, you know, the elite schools in Miami, and I wasn't going to have that clientele. So I didn't go for that clientele. I knew what my strengths were. My strengths were in the global clientele. And so I knew I had them. And so I was focused on them, and that's all I focused on. And so when the global client came into Miami, they were really strongly focused on.
And that was probably a time when there was a lot of money. I mean, there's always kind of been a lot of money coming to Miami, but especially during that period because of the.
This was in 04, 05. So that was sort of like the early Russian money that came into Miami, that came in a very strong way. And so, you know, I had a lot of clients from banking that were part of that already. And so, but I also did 2 to 3 trips a year to Moscow. And it was really the idea that you have to sort of be there. By the time they landed in Miami, it was too late. They weren't going to find an agent then. You needed to go where they were. So wherever your client base was, you need to make yourself that agent there.
So here's my question. Like, I could fly to Moscow. Well, I don't know if I could now. But let's pretend.
Can't today, probably.
Like, pretend it's not COVID. I could go fly to Moscow. And I've got some ideas. But what were your ideas to just fly to Moscow and, like, facilitate?
I had a strong client base already through banking. And so a lot of them already knew me, and I had a lot of colleagues and other financial institutions that I knew and I had worked with in the past. And so I did have a base that I started with, but you know, you didn't have to sort of be in banking in order to start building.
I was going
to
say, title the podcast, just be a banker first.
Yeah, no, definitely not. Definitely not. No. So, you know, you get creative, you start finding other independent real estate agents that want if the Russians were buying in Miami, they needed somebody to sell it to them, right? So start sort of like figuring out who that is and start reaching out to people. And to your
point,
you have social media now. You can actually go and do that now. You go on LinkedIn and you find estate agents in Russia, because you can actually go in and do it, and you can do a LinkedIn search by country. Start introducing yourself. You could start doing it today.
So what did you do back in 04, flying and traveling to Moscow 3 times a year?
So I already had my
you had your network.
I had my network, I had my client base, and I had a lot of people that I knew what they were looking for. A lot of people, you know, back then I also was talking about buying real estate as a currency hedge for a lot of them. You can't do this now. But buying, you know, so I spoke to them in financial terms, because that's what I knew. And so I spoke to them and they understood that. They understood they were buying cash, and if the underlying property gained in value, they were actually ahead. They were paying in Russian rubles, so they already had a hedge against their own currency because they were now in dollars. And so they understood that, and they understood that the property became a hedge for them. And so for I was able to do that. And I also understood the culture, right? I understood the fact that it was all done very discreetly, and you know, everybody was you know, didn't want to know what anyone else's business was. And I had an interesting story. I had one client that was on the Forbes list, and came in and he became a very good client of mine, and he referred someone to me but hadn't told me that. And so the client calls me up and he said, so-and-so told me to call you. And so I said, I'm sorry, I don't know who that is. And so they sort of said, wait, is this Michael Valdez? Is it? Yeah, it is. It's sort of like, and you don't know so-and-so? And I sort of said, I'm sorry, I don't. And so he sort of said, I must have the wrong number. And so I said, well, if you need any help on real estate, I'm happy to help you. And so they sort of said, I think I have the wrong number. And so then the next phone call I get is from my client, and said, you just told my friend that you didn't know who I was. And he says, why would you do that? And I said, you never gave me permission to say that I could. And he's like, oh my God. And he says, hold on. And so he gets his friend on the phone and we do a conference call, and he tells him the story. And that's sort of like, he says, wow. And it's sort of like, I had them both for life. It was like, they were my clients for life. It's little things, right? It's sort of like, it's respecting that, because sometimes it's a client doing a test. If you have a billionaire client, they want to know that they can trust you. Right. And yep. So it's like, I'm going to deny all day long until you tell me I'm not supposed to.
Exactly.
Well, so I'll protect that.
I always say, it's just leading my team, and I want to talk about team, but we'll talk about a couple other things first. It's like the tiniest gestures can, the things that seem like they're just nothing, the smallest gestures go leaps and bounds, but from the thoughtfulness, from that you are being thoughtful, from the trust, because I always say, you know, the higher the net worth client, the higher the net worth of the client, the more important it is that they know that you can hear them and listen.
Oh my gosh.
And that they can trust you.
And provide value. This same client had, he bought a house in a specific area, and there was a private school there. And so you needed two recommendations to get into the school. And so, I mean, he was in Moscow, but he bought, you know, he bought a $15 million house, but he didn't have the two recommendations to get his son into school. So I actually got him those recommendations. And I remember traveling to Moscow on one of my trips and meeting with him. And he brought up the idea of, how do we get my kid into school? And I had the acceptance letter in my pocket. And so I handed it to him. And he said, what is this? I said, read it. And he says, how did you do this? And I said, I already got you your acceptance letters, and you know, and he's now accepted in. And it's sort of like, are you kidding? And I was like, no. So I gave him something that money couldn't buy, right?
Yeah.
And so it just became, that was, for it turned into, you know, I was an extended family member at that point.
Well, there was a, like, I just wrote that down. You said, I gave him something money couldn't buy.
Correct.
Because when you've got that kind of money, there are things that money can't buy, like time, by the way, and the acceptance into a private school.
That's right.
That's an incredible story. So, you know, obviously you had international parents from Cuba and Spain, but you have become an international person and business person from the start of the entire world.
Yeah.
Was that curiosity? Was that coincidence?
You know, I think that I've always had a thirst for travel. I mean, I lived in Madrid with my grandmother when I was a small child. I loved that. My grandmother still lived in Madrid. I used to spend my summers with her. And it was something where I was exposed at such an early age that I can't imagine not traveling. You know, it's like, for me, it's so funny, you know, being with this situation with COVID this year. I sort of, you know, I did the math. It's the first year in 25 years that I won't go to Europe this year. And it's sort of simply because it's closed. And so it's closed to Americans. You know, I had a really good friend of mine that, that, you know, every year was like my summer holiday was going on their boat. And so their boat this year is in Greece. And so his wife called me the other day and sort of says, oh, we need your dietary restrictions. I said, Susie, I'm not going. There's no way that they allow Americans in Greece. So it's the first year that I'm not going.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where will this all go? Hey, we'll all have the antibodies.
That's right. Who knows, right? I don't think it's going to happen in 3 weeks though. So.
Yeah.
So. Unfortunately,
it'll be crazy to see what we have to say about all of this in a year, and then in five years.
I know it, right?
And then in 10.
I know. But you know what? It's also interesting just talking about the pandemic, and we were just talking about just connecting again, right? And so this is almost like the reset button too, where you're just connecting and, you know, either with yourself or family or friends and just figuring like what's important again. And so it's an interesting reset.
Such a gift. It's been such a gift. I know for many, I almost hesitate to say that because for many it hasn't.
Yeah.
But it has, I think it has, and you know, even bad things bring good things. But it has.
100%. It's how you start looking at things, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's really your vision towards things and how your outlook is.
And sometimes the world's telling you and think, like, I saw a social media post, this was actually a couple of months ago, from Jennifer Pino, a broker in Atlanta, or one of our managing brokers of Sotheby's or Atlanta Fund Homes. And she said, just when you know, it was like, what did it say? What if rather than falling apart, everything's actually just coming together?
Yes.
It was something like that. And I just was like,
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
It's kind of like when you go to renovate your house and you're like, what the hell was I thinking?
That's right. And then it comes together and it's a gorgeous thing.
And then it's like, oh, look.
Yes. Right? So true.
So I'm going to make an assessment of you. I think that you love international because, like, I hear about your childhood, I hear about, you know, your parents are from Cuba and Spain, your mom's from Spain, your grandmother, you went to visit her in Madrid, and then you're very much American. You were born in New York City in a very diverse city, but you are a person who wants, tell me if I'm wrong, truth, authenticity.
Oh, my Lord.
You want to get to the core of what like reality is, and you want to thrive in life, not suffer or cope. There are people who cope and there are people who thrive. And for you, being international says, okay, this is people, human beings, the human spirit. We are all one. And then as you travel, you're reminded of that by seeing different cultures and different people to what you said before. And I think that it like feeds your soul.
You know, I'm very black and white, and I am your number one fan, and I'll always protect you until you give me a reason not to. And so, and it's okay. I'll just keep going. But it's, but it sounds terrible, but I sort of like, I don't believe in second chances. It's sort of like, I just sort of like keep moving. And it is, but it's not that harsh that it's like a yes or a no. It's the space, right? So everything takes space. Everything takes time. Everything fills something. And so if you have a friend around you or someone around you that doesn't lift you and fill you, they're taking the space of someone that can.
And someone that you can fulfill, because usually 100%. When somebody's not fulfilling you, it's because they're coming to take, which yeah. gives you no room to give and them no room to actually receive the real gifts that the world has to offer.
It's 100% right. You know, I sort of say that success is a math problem. So when you start sort of thinking about, you know, how much you want to make, right, you sort of start breaking that down by 12. And now that goal is just a monthly goal. And you break it down by 4. And now that weekly goal seems a lot more attainable. And so you start doing that. You can do it with anything. You can do it not just with your finances, but you can do it with anything that you want to. And so for me, it's just also the idea that, you know, not only because my dad was a political prisoner and he had his own sort of like, you know, political yeah. career in Cuba, but it was also the idea at 26, I was actually diagnosed with colon cancer. And so it was, it was thankfully, it was caught in time and, you know, and it was fine. But when you're in your 20s, you're not supposed to be thinking about your own mortality. And so at that point, your whole sort of outlook in life changes. And yeah. so you start sort of thinking about the fact of, you know, your time is just a gift. You're on this planet as a gift and you're on borrowed time. And so the idea of it sort of being that I'm very black and white and I embrace every single moment is very true because I see it as a gift. And it's the idea that, you know, this moment I'm just embracing because I'm looking at you and I'm embracing this moment with you. And this moment for me is a gift because it's you and I connecting in a very real way. And it's that's something that to me is beautiful. It's something yeah. that I didn't have an hour ago because I wasn't on the call with you an hour yeah. ago. And so I'm embracing and really, you know, sort of like valuing what this is. And this is really quite beautiful. And it's just what, you know, in the next hour, I'll go and, you know, have dinner with some friends and I'll be embracing that moment. And so it's that idea that life is that series of moments that you celebrate and that you embrace. And so if something isn't that fulfilling to you, then you just remove it.
Well, it here's what I think of. Choose carefully.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to quote Peloton. On Peloton a few times a week. It's just my name. I don't even have a secret name on Peloton. I'm just Jerry Metcalf.
But, I love it.
But I don't remember his name because Allie Love is my girl. But he's the big flamboyant, cute guy on the brunette, whatever. But he's on, I don't even know his name. He's one of Allie loves my girl, but he's one I go to often. But he's on Peloton, and he says, on one of his workouts, he's like, this energy you have, it's very special. Be very careful what you do with it and how you choose to use it.
So true.
A little bit to what you said.
So true.
So in all of this, now that we've gotten in your mind and a little bit of how it operates and how you think, this will help us tap into...
Here we go.
Talking about teams and running a team. That is I feel that is probably the biggest challenge of most real estate agents. And how do you do it successfully? You did that. How did you do it? You gave us a little, but really.
I think the first part of it is that it has to happen organically. You have to decide that it's the right time for a team. Because sometimes you're supposed to just be by yourself. Sometimes you're supposed to just go have one or two assistants. It doesn't really mean that everyone should have a team. You know, it has to happen organically, because if it doesn't, it doesn't feel right, right? And the person who suffers is actually the client. The client will not be a part of that. So you have to understand that you as the brand has to be that brand. It has to be that when you actually have a team, any team member is actually representing you. You know, I think that one of our other really close friends, Nikki Field, does this better than anyone I know.
She's incredible.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like 20. It's someone she's got, I think it's like a 16 member team.
So yeah, it is. You're right.
So it's somebody who I respect tremendously, somebody that is one of my dearest friends here in New York, somebody that I see often socially with her and her husband and her children. Her daughter is part of her team. Her other daughter is a good friend of mine as well, somebody who I really respect and consider a close friend. She probably has one of the best teams in America. And it is something that's run like a corporation. And when you start looking at the amount of money that she creates in sales, and it's extraordinary. And, you know, it's the idea that she does run that like a business, her marketing, her market report, the way that she does that. You know, I always sort of like celebrate good choices. And she is a great example of that.
You know what I love about Nikki is when Nikki speaks, she speaks softly.
I know.
So you have to just, I always just want to be loud.
Yeah.
And you're like, what did you say?
Right, exactly. I'm going to miss something, right?
Nikki Fields is speaking. Shh, everybody listen. Listen. And it just gives you this sense of like, anything could happen.
That's so true.
And as long as she's present, it's going to be okay.
Absolutely.
That's Nikki.
You know, I got to tell you, I have a funny story. I have a funny Nikki story, and she'll probably hate that I'm going to tell this, but it's a fun story. And we were in India together, she and I.
Oh, yeah.
And we were opening up the Sotheby's India
office. Yes.
And so, Philip White was there too, the CEO of Sotheby's. And so we all, the people who were opening it wanted to take us out on a boat ride. And so, said to Nikki and her husband, Steve, do you want to come on the boat? It's supposed to be, it's supposed to be like a yacht ride. And so he comes by. And so we walk down to the pier, and she looks at the boat and she says, is that the boat that's taking us to the boat? And she says, no, that's the boat. She turns right on her heels and walks right back into the hotel.
God,
I adore that woman. I adore that woman.
That is great. I love that story.
Oh my God.
I can't wait to share. She's like, nope. I think she goes to India. I know Kevin on her team goes.
Kevin goes a lot. Kevin Brown goes a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, oh, yeah, Kevin, great. Yeah.
It's sort of like, is that the boat that takes us to the boat? No, that's the boat.
Oh my God. She
just... she didn't even say a word. She just pivoted and went right back into the lobby.
That's like the kind of thing you want on a video and like replay on TikTok or something.
It was awesome. You know.
Oh my gosh. Right, you got a hard stop in about, I think, 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do our final three questions I always do on the show. Number one, what has been what book of all books would you recommend we read that's been most beneficial to you in your personal and or business life or both?
So this is probably not going to be the answer you expect.
That's even better.
The Prince by okay. Machiavelli. Written in the 1500s, and it's a fable. For those that don't know, it's a story about a political advisor to the king in Italy at the time, and he had the king thought that he was turning against the family and had him imprisoned for 10 years. And then finally came out, and actually Machiavelli ruled after that. And so it's an interesting story from not just sort of like a coup d'etat, but there's a lot of lessons in that. And some of Machiavelli's poems while he was jailed was actually really poignant works. So The Prince.
What's your biggest takeaway? You told us the story, but what for you like really speaks to you in that book?
I think it is sort of the story that, you know, you need to always stay true to yourself.
Mm. You know, my quote for life is, have you ever read the book Relentless?
Yeah, of course.
The part of the book I remember, Mark Noah gave that to me, who's in LA. Do you know Mark?
If you don't,
you need to. Wonderful human being. So my favorite book in that quote is, in order to have what you really want, you must first be who you really are.
100%.
Be true to yourself.
100%. Absolutely.
See, I knew it. That's why.
Absolutely.
There you go, right there. The Prince.
100%.
What in your business, in your career of success, because most of our guests are agents, but you go way beyond that. What has been your biggest, usually I'm looking for like a tool in your business, but we can go like out there with this one. But what do you think has been your biggest asset or resource for being so successful?
Transparency.
Who you really are.
Transparency, and that sort of like, and that means a lot. You know, it's sort of like there's a lot of people that whole fake it till you make it thing isn't working. There's a lot of information out there, and a lot of people can sort of figure things out. And so you need to sort of be there, and somebody wants you as an advisor, right? So it's more, it's those sort of questions of, you know, what is that 3-bedroom sort of like cost? And it's like, the answer is not 5 million. The answer is sort of like, why do you want the 3 bedrooms? It's sort of like, what's the story behind it, right? How can I help you? This may not be the best thing for you, right? And so I remember there was during the height of the financial crisis, I was recommended to I knew that they were in the financial industry. And so one of my other former colleagues has referred him to me, and I was showing him and his wife some properties, and there was a particular penthouse that they wanted. And so the developer had lowered it, obviously because of the crisis, but not enough. And so I thought that it was still too high for them to get out at the price when, you know, the market returned. And I sort of said, you know, I don't think you should pay this for it. And so they sort of said, you're really talking yourself out of a 6-figure commission in the middle of the crisis. And I said, I just don't think it's the right thing for you. And so he looked at me, and we were at lunch, and he says, do you know what I do? And I said, oh, no, you're in finance. And he says, I'm running a vulture fund. And so he said, this was a personal purchase for my wife and I, but I'm running a vulture fund, and we're actually just opening and looking for properties in Miami. We hadn't found anyone as honest as you. And they hired me on the spot.
Wow.
On a retainer. They paid me $20,000 a month to sort of look for properties for them first. On the set of parameters that we did. And I got to tell you, 2009 was the best year I ever had in the industry. Could you imagine?
And it was the worst year for most real estate agents that were in business that year.
I had to hire 2 extra assistants. We wrote so many contracts.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is huge. What I love is you say that in transparency, because I do think, unfortunately, there are a lot of people who represent clients with a lot of money, and they look to say no just to prove they said no, rather than understand the no and how to truly guide them.
That's right.
I've been a listing agent where I've had buyers who I knew weren't buying it because the agent was not letting them, knowing I'm going to sell it for more money in a couple of weeks if you guys don't pull it together, and did. And so I love that story because I it's they're both sides of it, and making sure that's where you said earlier, know your market.
That's
I wrote them down about 5 pages of notes ago, but you know your market, know your client, know your strengths, and be transparent.
100% transparency. What's your third question?
If there's one thing we're going to remember, assuming we just forget everything else, what better that one thing be?
About me or?
About this conversation.
Oh.
What should we take away from it if we're just going to have to just not remember anything else?
You know, I think that for me, what I always want to sort of do is that the lesson is to give back, right? And so my biggest thing, and the reason that I started my podcast is because I used to mentor a lot of people in the industry. And it was just my greatest thing. It was one of the greatest successes when you actually see yourself contributing to changing somebody else's life. It actually, there's just no words for that, right? It just fills you so much. And to really sort of do that, the only thing that I really was lacking was more time to do it for more people. And so that was really why I started the podcast, was just to do best lessons for everyone.
Well, what I have found is there have been times where I remember I was giving a workshop at Sotheby's about 4 years ago or so, and I thought, why am I doing this? Like, I'm giving them all my good stuff. And my business just kept growing. The more I would give, because it does something to you here and your mindset. And
it does.
Maybe there's also some karma going on. I don't know. But it just, the more you give, the more like it just reproduces itself.
100%.
Creates your world of abundance rather than scarcity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. So the one thing we're going to remember is give.
That's it.
Love it.
Get back. Because that's the only thing that does matter.
Yeah.
You know, we're all in this together, you know, and right
Hashtag.
Now, no, it is, but it's like, when you start thinking about it, you know, it was so funny because in the beginning of the pandemic, I was in Asia actually, and I was giving a speech in Tokyo in February. Mm-hmm. And there was colleagues of mine in Singapore that were there. And so, I had a whole suitcase full of like, you know, hand wipes and masks and everything. And sort of like, because we already knew what was going on. And so it was like, I literally had a whole shopping bag full of like, you know, everything. And so when I was leaving, it was like, I was leaving in 2 days. And so my colleague in Singapore was telling me that they had absolutely nothing. Everything was, all the shelves were wiped out and everything. And he had a newborn. And so I literally gave him my entire suitcase of stuff. And so, you know, because everybody didn't know that then the US would be scarce of everything, you know, like 3 weeks later, but it was just what you were supposed to do. And then it was funny because then about 3 weeks later, there was no masks to be had in the US and blah, blah, blah. And then I actually got a care package from a friend of mine in Hong Kong because everything was past it then. So when you start looking about it, I gave it to somebody in Singapore, somebody in Hong Kong gave it back to me about a month later. And it was such a beautiful example right in your face of something where you just sort of, you just give.
Yeah.
You just give.
Exactly. It's amazing when you live in that world, how it just, it does create such abundance.
Yeah.
Thank you, Michael.
Oh my God, Jerry. Thank you. I'm so glad we got to hang out.
Me too.